Hello there. Today is Tuesday, September 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a life-threatening hurricane is barreling toward the east coast of the United States.
This is a very dangerous hurricane, but we are not going to gamble with the lives of the people of South Carolina, not a one.
President Trump is planning another possible meeting with the leader of North Korea. The U.S. closes the Palestinian diplomatic mission in Washington. Also ahead, how our own behavior as consumers may be an influence on modern-day slavery. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Florence is now a Category 4 hurricane and growing in size and strength. It's expected to strengthen into a more dangerous storm before making landfall possibly Thursday, bringing heavy rain and severe flooding, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center. Maps of the storm's trajectory showed it likely to come ashore somewhere near the border of North Carolina and South Carolina, the governors of both states declaring states of emergency. Hurricane specialist David Zelizer is with the National Hurricane Center. What can you tell us about the latest predictions?
Florence has been rapidly intensifying over the past 24 hours or so, and the size of the storm is also increasing. So the maximum sustained winds, as measured recently by NOAA Hurricane Hunter aircraft, are about 140 miles per hour with higher gusts, and the storm is moving west-northwest at about 13 miles per hour. We expect that it's going to gradually increase in forward speed as it starts to move closer to the Carolinas and the mid-Atlantic U.S. coast over the next few days. The important thing here is it's at this point we expect Florence to remain a major hurricane as it approaches the U.S. coast. It's important not to get too hung up on the details of exactly how strong it will be. Storms of this intensity sometimes can fluctuate over short periods of time up or down, but regardless of the exact intensity, we expect that Florence is going to be a very dangerous major hurricane when it makes landfall in the U.S. There's also going to be threats of storm surge flooding along the coast where it makes landfall, and then there's also an increasing threat of very heavy rain due to the fact that Florence is expected to slow down after it makes landfall, and because of that, you're going to have several days of very heavy rains, especially in some of the mountainous areas of the Carolinas. This could result in some life-threatening freshwater flooding just from the heavy rain. Right now, based on the latest forecast from the Weather Prediction Center, they are forecasting that some areas could see more than 15 inches of rain just within the next 7 days.
At this point, do you have a projection as to where it looks as if it will make landfall, or is it still too early to predict?
We certainly are focusing at this point somewhere along the Carolina coast for a potential landfall. But in terms of trying to pinpoint an exact city or town, it's still far too early to do that. The important thing to remember is that the impacts from Florence, especially inland, really doesn't matter where it makes landfall. We know it's going to produce very heavy rain and freshwater flooding inland. We know that it's going to create dangerous storm surge along a portion of the coast, not just where the center is, but especially to the north of wherever the landfall location is. So in this case, especially as the storm is increasing in size, the effects are going to be felt far from where that exact center point actually makes landfall.
So if it makes landfall in North Carolina, you're saying that there will still be intense impacts in states north of there, like Virginia?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And even to the south of where it makes landfall, even if in that location, say, the storm surge flooding could potentially be less, there's still going to be the risk of flooding from heavy rain. And there's still going to be strong winds. Right now, tropical storm force winds extend outwards up to 150 miles from the center. And we expect that Florence is actually going to grow in size a little more before it reaches the coast.
Do you know when it's expected to make landfall?
Based on the forecast, we expect that Florence will be approaching the coast sometime Thursday afternoon, late Thursday or early Friday. But the effects of Florence are going to reach the coast sooner. So at this point, people need to start thinking about getting their preparations finalized because you may only have a couple days before some of the outer bands of Florence begin to affect the coast and make further preparations very difficult, if not impossible.
Well, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster held a news conference Monday urging residents to evacuate.
We got the hurricane and the surge, which may be as high as 10 feet, maybe more, maybe less, we don't know, coming at us from the ocean, and then after that we have water coming down, flooding us. So we're in for a real episode here, And what we're emphasizing, we want everybody to be prepared.
He estimated about 1 million residents would flee the coast of his state, while thousands more evacuating North Carolina. And in Virginia, a little farther north, Governor Ralph Northam said tens of thousands of residents in low-lying coastal areas there are also being evacuated to higher ground.
We will see, with this potential stall that is predicted, catastrophic levels of inland flooding throughout the state. We have seen projections most recently this evening of upwards of 20 inches in some areas, with generally 8 to 10 to 12 to 15 inches across over half the Commonwealth.
And joining us now from Charleston, South Carolina, is resident Chris Morris. Chris, you're still there. You haven't evacuated. Can you tell us what's happening?
I'm under evacuation here, and I was just talking a little bit earlier with some people at a sandbag line, and kind of the straw poll of people of whether they're going to evacuate or not. The reality is, it looks like it's about half and half right now. A lot of people are kind of looking at the models, trying to see if the storm is actually going to swerve a little south and affect Charleston as much as we fear, or if it's going to go north into the Outer Banks and hit North Carolina, and we'll get sort of the outlying bands of the storm, which might be a hurricane one force wind, a category one force wind, or tropical storm force winds. If that's the case, I think you're going to see more people kind of ignore that evacuation order. But if this does turn out to be something that is category 2, 3, 4, then yeah, you're going to see a lot of people leaving town fast.
How are people reacting down there? Are they feeling a little concerned? It sounds like this storm is going to be pretty epic.
You're seeing a lot of people who lived through Hugo here have a couple flashbacks. There is some concern, but this is the third year in a row that Charleston has had to face potential evacuations because of a hurricane. So it's started to become almost old hat to residents here. 2 years ago, I don't remember the name of that storm, so let's just edit it out. But for the last 3 years now, we've had, if not hurricanes come through, 3 years ago there was what was called a 100-year rain event, which essentially was hurricane-like rain. No wind, but it was just massive flooding all over town. So it's a city where you sort of know what you're getting into when you live here.
What about the storefronts with the glass windows, schools, things like that?
All schools are closed probably for the rest of the week. That has not been official, but with an evacuation, that's not a bad guess. Storefronts, you're seeing a lot of people start to board up houses, and especially in the downtown area, you'll see storefronts board up. What you're seeing in stores like Walmart and grocery stores around town are pretty much what you'd expect. All the bread is off the shelves, bottled water is going fast, and those are the people that may be staying here or may want to just be prepared if they come back and they don't have power and they need to survive for a few days without it.
All right, thanks so much. Stay safe. That's Chris Morris in Charleston, South Carolina. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Memorials are underway to honor victims of the 9/11 across America. The U.S. accuses Venezuela's leader of operating a kleptocracy. A U.S. judge orders an accused female Russian agent to be kept in jail. And Canada's foreign minister will hold NAFTA talks later today as time runs short. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Trump administration lashed out Monday at the International Criminal Court and the Palestinians. National Security Advisor John Bolton threatened the ICC with sanctions if it proceeds with investigations into alleged war crimes by American troops in Afghanistan. And he lauded the closure of the Palestinian diplomatic mission in Washington that the State Department had announced just an hour before. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, formally represents all Palestinians. The closure was just the latest move the administration has taken against the Palestinians and in favor of Israel. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal if he was surprised by the U.S. action.
Yes and no. I'm surprised because I didn't think that they will go this route this fast. I'm not surprised because the American strategy has been to continue to escalate the cost of not cooperating with the U.S. policy and strategy, and to hope that this kind of escalation would lead to some degree of compromise and cooperation on the part of Palestinian authorities. Now, this doesn't seem to have happened so far. The question now really is, what will happen if this particular step does not lead to the desired effects of bringing the Palestinian Authority around, which it is not likely to do given the circumstances? Therefore, the way I see it at this moment is two things. One, this is likely to increase the tension in the Middle East at large. Number of countries which have been supportive of Palestinian Authority and Palestinian independence are likely to basically argue that they told you so. They're going to move forward and be more supportive of the Palestinian authorities and their cause. So while the possibility of or the certainty with which one could say that the Palestinians will fall in line is not declining, at the same time, the tensions in the region could very well reverberate against the U.S. interests. So I don't know what's the purpose behind this strategy. It looks like a very short-term kind of strategy, hoping that it will bring about the desired result, and it doesn't seem to be doing that.
Apparently, justification for this move was that there have been no direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel. To the contrary, quote, PLO leadership has condemned a U.S. peace plan they have not yet seen and refused to engage with the U.S. with respect to peace efforts and otherwise.
That's exactly my point. When you have sort of a roadblock of this kind, where you have a conflict of this kind, you have to be more imaginative and more resourceful when you try to take an alternative step. If you take a step as this one, which is like an ultimatum, it becomes very hard for the other side to cooperate. Basically, what they're going to do is they're going to go and tell their supporters, look, we told you that this is the way the U.S. position is and this is how it is developing. And to that extent, their support gets strengthened in the region. I think one needed to be more patient and pursue the diplomatic route in a much more careful and a steady fashion.
Taken together, of course, the U.S. on Saturday announcing it's redirecting funds from a Palestinian network of hospitals in East Jerusalem and, of course, the U.N. agency that deals with Palestinian refugees. Taken together, what do you make of these moves?
The way I see it is the moves were intended to increase the cost to Palestinians for not cooperating on a plan which is yet to be developed. They have obviously called for something else, but they're reacting by saying, all right, if this is what you want to do, we are going to escalate the tension, we are going to escalate the cost to the other party as well. Now, what does it do? It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't support the process of transformation or a move towards peace in the region. And therefore, taking away all these resources may be desirable from the point of view of the U.S. strategy, but it does in the region is that it worsens the possibility or cause of stability and peace.
The head of the PLO delegation to the U.S. accused the Trump administration of dismantling decades of U.S. vision and engagement in Palestine, quote, Ambassador Hussam Zumlot, weaponizing humanitarian and developmental aid as political blackmail does not work.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't work. Because, you see, for it to work, what you have to do is to make sure that there is no alternative means of at least partially making up for the losses of one of the parties. If that party can make up those losses, number one, or at least partially make up those losses, and then use this policy initiative as a vehicle to seek support from elsewhere, then it ends up generating greater degree of instability in the region. That doesn't, it's not useful for anyone. It doesn't serve the U.S. interest for peace in the region.
The Palestinian Authority said it will not abandon its principles following the decision to close the PLO Washington office. U.S. President Donald Trump received a letter from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders says Trump is doing well in handling Kim Jong-un, as she described the letter to reporters Monday.
Very warm, very positive letter. We won't release the full letter unless the North Korean leader agrees that we should. The primary purpose of the letter was to request and look to schedule another meeting with the president, which we are open to and are already in the process of coordinating that.
Sanders told reporters that a military parade in Pyongyang on Sunday was a sign of progress in talks on denuclearization because it didn't feature any nuclear missiles. The two leaders have been discussing North Korea's nuclear program since their June 12th summit, which has been criticized for being short on concrete details about how and whether Kim is willing to give up on a nuclear weapons program. Recent reports have indicated that Pyongyang has not stopped its nuclear program. Joining us now to discuss is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. So, Jamil, what do you make of the warm words from Trump amid reports of satellite images showing North Korea has not stopped its nuclear program?
The reports we've heard from the intelligence community that have gotten out to the press are that North Korea, as of last year, had the capability to build about 6 nuclear warheads a year, and that we're expecting that they're going to produce the same number this year. So it's not that they've stopped their nuclear production program. To the contrary, they're continuing to build their overall nuclear capability and continue to work at the same pace. What has changed, they're no longer testing missiles, which is a positive development, to be sure, and a lot of people have made a lot of the fact that their recent parade didn't have missile vehicles. So there are some positive signs. That being said, obviously the sort of paper deal that was reached at the re-summit in June was not particularly beneficial to the United States. In a lot of ways, it was not as strong as prior deals. And of course, those prior deals have led to a nuclear armed North Korea. So, you know, some challenges and some opportunities, certainly, but definitely not a great situation with North Korea right at this moment.
What do you make of the president's warm comments about someone who's considered, you know, one of the most ruthless dictators in the world?
Well, look, I mean, the president's obviously made some very positive comments about Kim Jong-un in the past. He's made positive comments about Vladimir Putin, positive comments about the Chinese premier. Obviously, these are folks who are not well-regarded when it comes to human rights and the human rights community. And so that those are concerning words. At the same time, the president is trying to do a deal with North Korea that hopefully will move the world in a safer, more positive direction. So it's not surprising that he's trying to sort of butter up Kim Jong-un. In the past, as you know, he's made some very nasty comments about Kim Jong-un also, in particular, personally critical of Kim Jong-un and at times his stature and other features of Kim Jong-un. So what we see here for the president is, I think, what works for him, which is personal criticism, personal praise. And then the question is, what does he do on substance? And at first, we saw a very aggressive stance by the president that apparently did concern the North Koreans and brought them to the table, and then ultimately a deal that wasn't particularly beneficial. And then he reversed that course and said, look, I'm not going to send the Secretary of State to North Korea to negotiate if they're not going to really work on denuclearization. So we've seen a back and forth on the substance, you know, with the current situation being a more positive trend. We've all seen a back and forth on the sort of atmospherics, right? You know, criticisms and personal name-calling at the outset, and now compliments and hugs and kisses. So, you know, we'll see what happens. At the end of the day, all that matters is what happens substantively, and we have seen positive developments in the sense that the North Koreans are not testing weapons, but also negatives in that they're still building nuclear warheads.
We have heard in recent days reports from, obviously, this new book that just came out from a very credible journalist, among this anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, saying that there is sort of a alternate policy going on where the president is potentially has national security policies, but others are not following it, basically, that are for concern over national security. Where would North Korea potentially fit into something like that? And do you have any comment on that?
Well, look, I mean, I think that the news that there are folks in the administration, both politicals and careers, who are concerned that the president's approach is not the right one and are at times impeding it or maybe even at times simply slow rolling some of the things is no surprise. We've heard these reports since the beginning of the administration about people of the president's own party in his own leadership team, his senior staff saying, look, you know, we're just going to slow walk this. Maybe he'll forget this question he's asked or this summit he wants to have with Vladimir Putin. Maybe he'll put it to one side and we'll come back to it later. And so we've heard these stories before. Certainly the new reporting in the book and the op-ed are starker versions of that, but this is not new news. And there's a balance here, which is to say, obviously the president was elected by the American people. He has the will of the American people to set policy. What's more concerning here, it would be concerning if it's the bureaucracy trying to stop the president from imposing the will of the elected masses that elected him to do these things. At the same time, when it's people in his own party, in his own senior leadership, that's when people should be concerned, because then it represents not the will of the elected people, but a concern within those who were elected. I mean, a point by the president that even his own policies don't reflect what the voters were looking for or what's expected of a president at the current time. And that's, I think, what is concerning about what we're seeing in these reports from the Woodward book and from the op-ed.
All right. Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
VOA's international edition continues. Well, following the lead of the UK, Australia's coalition government has been active on working to end human trafficking and modern-day slavery with efforts to engage big business. It's putting forth legislation requiring larger Australian companies to disclose knowledge of human trafficking, forced labor, and related practices among their suppliers and subcontractors. Internationally, Western firms are facing similar calls, but according to experts, it's not translating all the time to consumer conduct. Joining us now is Jolyon Ford, professor of law at Australia National University, who has written extensively on this. Well, it sounds like modern-day slavery is alive, and consumers often don't realize they're unknowingly contributing to it.
Everyone understands slavery as a sort of historical phenomenon, and you know, in terms of the human rights movement and human rights discourse that we know today, that slavery was the first big international human rights issue. There's less awareness today that there are still people, you know, in this time and hour of the 21st century, there's still people who are not free to leave where they work or are not compensated for their work or in other forms, to all intents and purposes, slaves or living in slave-like conditions. And some of those people are trafficked into forced labor, and some of them are in sort of much longer-term bonded labor situations, especially in parts of South Asia. And what I suppose the issues that the Australian government is working on and others in the EU and the UK is, what does this mean in terms of goods and services that find their way into global supply chains and so into kind of first world markets, where the conditions under which some of those things were made amount in effect to slavery?
What about consumers? Is there anything they can try to do or not do?
I think consumers are the missing piece of this puzzle. So here in Australia, the EU, in the UK, in California has a Supply Chains Transparency Act piece of legislation requiring company reporting on child labor and forced labor, retail and manufacturing sectors. So there are parts of the world where there are legal instruments and legal regimes that deal with this, but how useful are they really if consumers themselves don't know about these issues, or even if they know about them, they don't really act on them in the way in which they choose their or adapt their purchasing behaviors? And certainly in Australia, the whole debate on modern slavery has been led, it's actually been led by big business, by one particular very wealthy businessman who has championed this issue. So it's actually been government and big business that has been leading the drive for more action on slavery in supply chains, and it's consumers who are sort of only slowly coming to the picture, and consumer awareness is actually quite low.
Is it a big problem in Australia particularly?
It's not a problem particularly in Australia, but Australia's taking sort of quite proactive steps about the prospect that Australian companies' supply chain, so supplying into the Australian consumer market, might be tainted in some way, the human labor conditions under which things are made in other parts of the world. So in Southeast Asia, in North Asia and China and Vietnam and Cambodia and elsewhere. So to give an example from Australia that's prompted some attention, a well-known surf brand procured its winter range 2016, it thought from China, from a Chinese contractor, but the Chinese contractor had subcontracted to North Korean factories where the workers are not compensated for what they do. So in effect, they're forced labor. Hmm. So it's those sorts of situations which makes Australia, as you know, in the sort of regulatory state of Australia, say, well, what is our responsibility, authority, or opportunity to try and regulate in some way the ways in which forced labor and human trafficking and modern slavery find their way into into supply chains. So Australia's adapting a model from 2015 that the UK came up with, which forces larger companies doing business in the UK and in future in Australia to report annually on what steps they are taking in their supply chain to address these risks.
How are they coming to be in these situations? How is this happening?
So in India, there are generations of bonded labor, some of the highly stratified classes in that society. But there are all sorts of ways in which people might come into a forced labor situation. The most familiar ones are the ones that we see here onshore in Australia itself, relate to the sex industry. So people who are brought in under certain pretenses that they will work in hospitality or entertainment industry, but then find themselves working in effect in the sex industry and are not free to leave. Their documents are taken away. In those sorts of situations, especially where there's a threat of violence, you can see this as working in effect in a slavery-like conditions. But across our whole region in Southeast and South Asia, there are all sorts of situations where people are trafficked. In other words, they are moved as commodities into factories, into extractive processes on farms or in the fishing industry, and are forced to work and are not free to leave. So, for example, refugees from Burma, Myanmar, crossing the border into Thailand, are offered a job on a fishing boat. But what they don't realize is that once they're on that vessel, they can't leave. Their passports and documents are taken away, and they spend 3, 5, who knows how many years, unable to leave that work. And their option is to stay working on the boat or be pushed into the sea, pretty much, if you want to put it as starkly as that. What does that mean for Australian companies that buy tuna fish from the Gulf of Thailand, where it's possible, not inevitable, but it's possible that some of that was caught on boats that use effectively modern slaves?
All right, that's Jolyon Ford, professor of law at Australia National University. A stuffed toy monkey called Tiwa holds some of Nigeria's oldest folk tales, and it's helping to revive the traditional practice of storytelling by appealing to a younger generation. Faith Lapidus reports.
In a little village, there lived a man who had 2 wives and 2 daughters.
In nearly every culture around the world, storytelling was traditionally how one generation passed knowledge to the next. But today, in our multimedia-connected world, such folk tales are rarely told. And that's where Tiwa, the wise monkey, comes in. Tiwa was created by entrepreneur Tola Akanbi, who says Nigerians are losing the oral tradition of storytelling.
Nobody tells their kids, sitting them down to tell them stories nowadays, but Tiwa helps to bring that back. Then also, all the stories that are on Tiwa, they teach morals, good behavior, you know, why you should not be greedy, why you should be hardworking, why you should obey your parents. So all those things are what children can benefit from.
My favorite story is the fisherman and his greedy wife. There was a fish who can grant 3 wishes, but his wife wanted more. I learned that you should appreciate what you have.
Tiwa tells 30 folk tales in English with songs, names, and familiar expressions in the local Yoruba language. Tunji Sodomirin, a storyteller and theater arts lecturer at the University of Lagos, says Tiwa has the potential to cut across different cultures.
What I feel is that, okay, this is a way of appealing to, you know, white or black or whatever culture that you come from. This is teddy bear, which represents, you know, the Western tradition, and the Tiwa, you know, in terms of name and the content of the story is highly indigenous of Yoruba culture, which is a good fusion.
Because of the high cost of production in Nigeria, Tiwa is manufactured in China, imported to Nigeria, and then repackaged for a domestic market. Akambi hopes to produce the next batch of Tiwa storytelling dolls in Nigeria. The plan is to expand the number of Tiwa's folk stories and to include other popular languages used in Nigeria, such as Hausa, Igbo, and Yoruba. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today. Thanks for being with us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.